This is the third recap and rebuttals episode for season one of Solving JFK. Today, I'll be joined once again by Jeff Crudell from JFK, The Enduring Secret podcast. We have a very hefty task ahead of us in recapping the medical evidence from the last seven episodes and responding to some rebuttals and counterpoints that were sent in. Using a scale of likely Warren report, leans Warren report, inconclusive, leans conspiracy, all the way to likely conspiracy, Jeff and I will go on the record with our conclusions on each issue. Specifically, we'll talk about whether the single bullet theory is likely correct, whether CE-399 could have been the single bullet, whether the autopsy photos and x-rays show Kennedy's body in the same condition as it left Parkland Hospital, whether the Zapruder film is authentic, and finally, which direction did the fatal headshot that killed President Kennedy come from?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Jeff, welcome back to Solving JFK. Thanks for coming back again.
Yeah, it's great to be here, Matt. Thanks for having me.
As a reminder, Jeff's podcast is called JFK, The Enduring Secret. You can find it everywhere you find podcasts. He's got 163 episodes out so far. So, you know, you get through all the Solving JFK stuff, you're hungry for more, do go check out JFK, The Enduring Secret. Even if you're not done with this podcast, it's a wonderful podcast. We've got a lot to cover, so let's go ahead and jump into it. And I'm just going to be recapping these points. If you want an in-depth discussion, then go back and listen to episodes 13 through 19. It's all detailed. We have the transcripts and the citations at solvingjfkpodcast.com. Issue number one, is the Warren Report's single bullet theory likely correct? Well, we'll start out looking at the throat wound. Most of the Parkland doctor's initial impressions were that the throat wound was an entry wound in the neck, including Dr. Perry, the surgeon who performed the tracheostomy over the throat wound, and Drs. Aiken, Baxter, Carrico, Clark, Crenshaw, Jones, McClelland, and Peters. The autopsy doctors did not examine the throat wound very thoroughly because they thought that it was just a tracheotomy. The wound wasn't dissected because, as Dr. Pierre Fink testified at the Clay Shaw trial, the doctors were told not to dissect the wound by military higher-ups. It is true that the Dallas doctors who testified before the Warren Commission did admit that it's possible that the throat wound could have been an exit wound. But there's a big caveat to that admission. The doctors did not volunteer that they had changed their position. Instead, Warren Commission lawyer Arlen Specter asked them a more complicated version of this question. If the bullet exited from the front of Kennedy's throat, could the wound in the front of Kennedy's throat be an exit wound? The doctors all admitted that the answer to that question was, of course, yes. If it exited from the front, it could be an exit wound. But they didn't say that that's what happened. They simply responded yes to Specter's hypothetical question. So that's the throat wound. Moving on to the back wound. The location of the back wound is very important because if it was too low to have exited from the throat wound on the same trajectory as the bullet was coming down from the school book depository, six stories up, then the single bullet theory can't be true. The Parkland doctors did not even see the back wound, so there's no Parkland versus Bethesda dichotomy when it comes to the back wound. The Warren report says that the back wound was, quote, near the base of the back of the neck. The Seibert and O'Neill FBI report, which documented what the doctor said and did at the autopsy, says that the back wound was of a short depth with no point of exit. Now, the counter argument to the short depth point that's raised here is that rigor mortis would have set in. So it would have been hard to get a probe through the muscles if the bullet went through. But these are doctors who presumably would have known about rigor mortis. Other documents that support the wound being lower on Kennedy's back and too low for the throat wound to be a plausible exit wound, given this downward trajectory from the school book depository, are the following. The Seibert and O'Neill report, which says that the wound was, quote, below the shoulders and 2 inches to the right of the middle line of the spinal column. 5 Secret Service agents are on record saying that it was between the shoulder and the neck, or in the soft part of the shoulder. The autopsy facing sheet shows the wound being in the upper back and to the right. Chief Counsel of the Warren Commission, J. Lee Rankin, said in a closed-door commission meeting on January 27, 1964, when the commissioners presumably had access to the autopsy report, that, quote, "We have a picture of where the bullet entered the back, that the bullet entered below the shoulder blade to the right of the backbone, which is below the place the picture shows the bullet came out in the neckband of the shirt in front. The death certificate itself, which is written by Kennedy's personal physician, Dr. Berkeley, puts the wound at the 3rd thoracic vertebra, which is consistent with the upper right shoulder, not the top of the neck. The holes in Kennedy's coat and shirt are also consistent with the wound being around T3. They're not consistent with the Warren Report's position. And the counterpoint here is, well, Kennedy was leaning forward, so his shirt would have bunched up. And this is true to some extent, sure, but not nearly enough to move his shirt and his coat up inches. The photo itself shows the wound in the upper right back. If you look at the autopsy photos, which haven't technically been released, but there have been leaked ones that have been authenticated, and you look at that photo, it looks like it's at T3. It doesn't look like it's at the top of his neck. Kennedy's head is tilted up to make it look like the back wound is closer to his head if you look at this photo. But like I said, it looks like it's the 3rd thoracic vertebra, which is consistent with all the other information. When you combine all of that with the trajectory, the idea that the bullet was fired from the school book depository, if we're talking about the Warren Commission's single bullet theory, the exit wound on the throat, like we said to start this segment out, has got to be lower than the entrance wound in the back. And T3 is lower than the throat. So my conclusion to the answer of is the single bullet theory credible is no. The Warren Report's single bullet theory is not correct, and I rate this issue as strongly leaning towards conspiracy. Jeff, that was a lot of information that I just put out there, but what do you have to say about that? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, Matt, there's a lot to unpack there, but let's keep it simple. The single bullet theory is a concept that was put together to justify the fact that they originally started with 3 shells and everything had to be done with 3 shots. So it was a reverse engineering of an answer that would be plausible under those circumstances. So by its very nature, certainly that doesn't make it false, but rather than letting the evidence lead you forensically to where you should end up, wherever that takes you, it was an engineered conclusion to begin with. So you have to understand the nature of the way this was derived. Now, let's talk about this a little bit. This bullet, if it came from the 6th floor of the school book depository, passed through Kennedy, then passed through Conley, then after passing through Conley, goes through his wrist and then lands in his thigh. And in so doing, while most of that trajectory or path was through soft tissue, once it entered Conley's body, it hit a rib and then it hit a wrist. So if you believe that number one, that actually happened, and number two, it happened with the bullet that they gave you, then you look at the condition of the bullet, those two things don't add up. You know, you've also talked in the same context, this issue of whether it was an entrance wound or an exit wound and the front of President Kennedy's neck. While that is an element of the autopsy and the question about the single bullet theory, more importantly, the question there to be answered is, if it did come from the front, then it's game over because you've got a second shooting location. And whether one shot went through everybody else or not is totally irrelevant, because at the end of the day, we're trying to figure out whether or not there was a shooting conspiracy here.
Right.
And so here's what I'll offer up on that, which I think is just kind of a simple view of the world. Parkland Hospital is an inner city urban hospital in Dallas, Texas, a place where there are probably more guns on the face of the earth per capita. And typically gunshot wounds go to those kinds of hospitals. Dr. Jones did an interesting look back, and I can't remember the exact number, but I think they average more than three or four a day there. The trauma team in the emergency room was highly experienced in dealing with gunshot wounds. When the president came in, was placed on the trauma table, and they were working feverishly to revive him. Obviously, they made a decision very quickly to perform a tracheotomy and insert a tube. But there was a period of time, probably minutes, not that long, I would say 5 to 10 minutes typically, maybe even less, where he's on the table and they have a clearly observed wound. And particularly Dr. McClellan, who was actually not performing the procedures, you know, Dr. Perry performed the tracheotomy. And they could look at that wound and they could determine that it had very typical characteristics of an entrance wound. It was about the size of the missile. It was round. It had defined edges similar to an entrance wound. There isn't anybody that saw that wound before it was obliterated by a tracheotomy incision that doesn't believe it was an entrance wound. And so here you are talking with a group of doctors who arguably have considerably more experience in looking at that. And by the way, if there was anything nefarious that went on, it certainly hadn't gone on up to that point. So whatever it is they were looking at for those few minutes was pristine in nature. The issue with a single bullet theory is that there's too much evidence of other things happening to just believe that, in fact, all that damage was done by one bullet. Quite frankly, Conley, as you know, to his dying day, and he actually held a press conference on it because he was sort of tired of hearing about it, that he was struck after the president was hit the first time. He was not struck by the same bullet, and he swears by that, and he was there. He very carefully depicts the moment at which he hears the shot. He absolutely knows that it's a gunshot. He turns to his right. He then comes back on his way back to looking left when he's hit. It's very clear. He's hit by a different bullet. Why the commission, this is another example of where the commission chose to ignore the best evidence. And we could go on and on, but this theory, which, and if you don't mind, I'm going to back up just 1 second, Matt, because I think this is important. They started out with three shells. Then it was, look, it's just the lone gunman. It's just the guy with the three shells. Then it's a Mannlicher Carcano. That's the second variable, which is a bolt action rifle that can only fire every 2.2 seconds. Then they get the Zapruder film, which has timestamps every 18th of a second. And all of a sudden, it's pretty clear that you just can't have anything more than three shots in the sequence. And when the TAG, and you've covered all this, but when the TAG information became available, when it was very clear that there was a missed shot and they had to account for that separately, with all those multivariable facts, it changed everything. And there was a circumstance at that point where they could not account for everything that happened inside the wounds that came to Conley and Kennedy They could not account for those with only three shots. So they had to reverse engineer something that was suitable. And this is what happens when you get into reverse engineering things versus letting the evidence itself lead to a conclusion.
Sure. Okay, a couple of questions, specifics on this for you here. So the front shot, so the idea that the throat wound is an entrance wound, the challenge that I've always had on that is, well, we just don't have any, there's no exit of it. And if it's in the body, it wasn't found. Now, Doug Horn would say, well, yeah, that's because they took the bullet out of the body before the autopsy. Okay. But I just don't have any, there's not like a document that says we took the bullet out of the body before the autopsy. So I just, that's a question mark for me, is what happened to the bullet if it was an entry wound. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, my thinking has evolved. I have exactly the same question, right? I mean, you bullets don't go through something and then just disappear, right? His head level was higher than the back seat. So if a shot was essentially at a low angle, across sort of the bow, and it punctured his neck and exited, then you would have had to have either have landed in the rear trunk at an angle in the car, or it would have skipped. We don't hear much in the way of discussion about any shot heading west to east along Elm and toward Houston. However, if the presumption is that it lodged in his body, then you have to presume some nefarious activity there, right? I mean, right. That's the bottom line. And let me tell you where I'm at with that. Obviously, no one's ever come forward and said, yeah, there was one there. However, the cumulative evidence that is, it's circumstantial, but it's pretty persuasive, in my opinion, that there were things done in the course of the autopsy, the gathering of evidence, the handling of evidence, and we get into the details in that in a minute. The cumulative effect of that for me makes it very plausible that they did find that bullet and that bullet disappeared. And that's speculation, of course, absolute speculation, because there isn't a clear evidence of that. No one's admitted to that. Look, I'll offer one thing up. It's absolutely clear that the president's body came in a shipping casket when it first came into the morgue. There is no debate about that. I mean, there is very good, solid evidence, credible evidence that is, you know, essentially reinforced by more than one party, and that are credible. You have all of these things pointing all in the same direction that these activities were going on. So you have to be suspect.
Sure. On the Zapruder film, so I always say, I don't know, I can't really tell. I've looked at different, you know, there's like some versions that are like sharpened or whatever and slowed down. And as I listened to Connolly's specific description of what happened, I went back and watched it over and over again, because it seems like most people do have clear opinions about the Zapruder film. I think I'm like the only one who's like doesn't really want to jump in, because it's hard for me to tell. It's so grainy sometimes. But it does seem clear that Kennedy's shot, he's got his hands up to his throat, comes right when immediately when he comes into view from behind the sign where he was hidden from view, his hands are up to his throat. Connolly is not wounded at that. He's turning around, he's looking, and then just a few, I'm sure people know the exact frames, a few, you know, frames later, too long for it to be the same bullet, he's just in pain, writhing. J. Edgar Hoover even says, when he's talking to LBJ, that there were three bullets. The first hit the president, the second hit the governor, the third hit the president. So you're right, that was their initial theory, and then they changed it. So, and LBJ also didn't believe it, which was interesting to hear him say to Senator Richard Russell. All right, let's go to the next issue, which is, it's related. This is the sort of the point B of the single bullet theory. So number two, is CE-399 the single bullet that caused the damage to Kennedy and Connolly? So we just concluded that the single bullet theory is not likely, but the separate question is whether CE-399 could possibly be the single bullet if it was likely. All right, so let's dive into that. The first issue we have is the chain of custody. Six people handled it, but only the last two could definitively identify the bullet. And supposedly, FBI agent Bardwell Odom interviewed the first two people to have the bullet, but he later said that he never interviewed anyone at Parkland Hospital about CE-399 and he never even saw or possessed this bullet. And there's also no FBI 302 reports that would have been generated had Odom interviewed these people. This tends to show that the summary document regarding CE-399 has been fabricated. And O.P. Wright later told researchers that the bullet he was given was pointed and not round like CE-399. So this is where rebuttal number one comes in. And the first rebuttal is this. It's not correct to say that Tomlinson, Wright, Johnson, and Rowley all said CE-399 did not look like the bullet they handled. And the citation provided in support of this rebuttal is Commission Document 1258. It is an FBI memo of July 7th, 1964. All right, so I'm glad this was sent in because this is a big inference split. So remember, we just mentioned how Bardwell Odom was interviewed by Dr. Gary Aguilar, researcher, who, when he couldn't find any supporting 302 documentations in the declassified FBI files that were the files that led to the creation of the document that summarized this chain of custody, which is CE-2011. They then went, Dr. Aguilar reached out to Odom, who said, you know, I never did it. What they're saying I did in CE-2011 is fabricated and not real. That's what Bardwell Odom said. So it seems like this, the person that sent this in is just disregarding Odom's story. So what I'm saying is there is a document, CE-2011, that does in fact say that they did identify it. But that document is fraudulent given the fact that Bardwell Odom says that it's fraudulent. So, you know, now if you don't believe Bardwell Odom, then you would believe CE-2011. But we've got the FBI agent who supposedly interviewed them saying he never interviewed them. He never interviewed anybody about the bullet at Parkland. He never even had the bullet. And we would expect to see 302 reports from him and the underlying files, which have been declassified, and there are no such reports. So that's how I reached my conclusion on the first two. Regarding Johnson and Rowley, let me read verbatim from the document that was sent to me as a rebuttal. Quote, Johnson advised he could not identify this bullet as the one he obtained from O.P. Wright. Next paragraph, quote, Rowley advised he could not identify this bullet as the one he received from Special Agent Richard Johnson. Okay, so that's why I said that. That's my answer to rebuttal number one. But if you don't believe the whole Bardwell Odom thing, that is a split point in inferences. So there you go. Moving on to the next little subtopic, the condition of CE-399. My favorite document to summarize this is HSCA Exhibit F-294, which shows CE-399 next to two bullets that were fired into a bale of cotton, and then another bullet next to that, which is a little bit bent in the middle, that hit a goat rib, and then another bullet next to that, which is totally smashed on the end, that hit a human cadaver wrist. The ones that look most similar to CE-399 are the ones that were just fired into cotton. It's hard to deny what your eyes are seeing with this picture. I mean, it looks like CE-399 didn't hit any bone, at least. So here's where rebuttal number two comes in. It's not fair to compare CE-399 to the other bullets that are shown on this HSCA exhibit because, according to Larry Sturdivan, the other bullets were fired from much closer range at near muzzle velocity, meaning the original velocity of when the bullet comes out of the gun. But CE-399 was fired at a target that was much further away. So this is presuming Oswald's firing from the sixth floor. So the velocity would be materially decreased such that the bullet was traveling fast enough to cause the damage it did, but not fast enough for the bullet itself to be damaged. So the argument is, hey, you fire it from further away, it's going slower, so it's going to cause more damage without being damaged itself. You know, my first thought on this is that the test should have been conducted in a way that would allow apples to apples comparisons. I'd have to look more at the scientific claims here, but I've never seen a bullet that hit wrist and rib that looked in as good of shape as CE-399 did. And remember, Larry Sturdivant is the same guy who says that JFK's back into the left motion in the Zapruder film was a last dying spasm because he shot a goat in the head and it put its arms out. So I'm not sure that I would give his research a ton of credibility, to be candid. That's an inference point that perhaps I differ from the person who sent this in, which we very much appreciate. Okay, the next thing, the weight of CE-399. So the current weight of CE-399 is within the average of all bullet weights for Carcano bullets. When I say the current weight, the one in the National Archives, what it weighs. But when we add in the grains from Connolly's wrist combined with any grains that were embedded in Connolly's thigh and never removed before he died, that would likely be more than an average Carcano bullet. That's speculation a little bit, but that's the idea. Rebuttal number three is that Dr. Gregory said the fragment in Connolly's thigh was 0.5 mm by 2 mm, which equates to 17.8 milligrams. And one grain is 64.8 milligrams. So in other words, the fragment weighed about a fourth of a grain. And when you add that to the existing bullet weight, it would not have made the bullet too heavy to be plausible. So, you know, zooming into the hyper details, that's what we got to do. This rebuttal really does do damage. If this information is correct, that 64.8 milligrams equates to a fourth of a grain and we add it to the existing weight, that would undermine the idea that adding the fragments from Connolly's thigh would make the bullet too heavy. So given, you know, if those calculations are true, I will concede that point. So all this means is that we can't rule out CE-399 as being credible or not based on the weight of the bullet alone. So that's fair. And I would concede that point. The next thing is we have the Connolly wrist grains. CE-842, we have this exhibit, and it's the fragments of bullets from Connolly's wrist, but they don't fit anywhere into CE-399. Like if it was a 3D puzzle and you had to put it together and okay, where does this piece go? What about this little piece? And the answer is there's nowhere plausible that they could go on the bullet. So the puzzle pieces just don't fit, which is a very, you know, to me, that's pretty persuasive. We also talked about there being some confusion with the handoff of the bullet fragments and whether there was an extra bullet that was maybe given to Officer Nolan that day, because there's this whole mix up of, is it fragments? Is it a bullet? Did Nurse Bell give it to Officer Nolan or somebody else? Did he get it from someone else or was it Nurse Bell? So here's where rebuttal number four comes in. Now, Nurse Bell says that she gave the bullet fragments to a man who was not in uniform. Officer Nolan, who's listed on the written chain of custody, says that he was in uniform that day. But this rebuttal claims that he probably was not in uniform because Texas highway patrolmen were not required to be in uniform. There's also a written note that was discovered by researcher Gary Murr in the National Archives that is a receipt for Nurse Bell giving the fragments to Officer Nolan. So given the existence of this document, it's possible that there was confusion that Audrey Bell did actually give bullet fragments from Connolly's wrist to Officer Nolan. You know, she could be mistaken. He could be mistaken. I would want to know the provenance of this document from Gary Murr and the details surrounding how it got to the National Archives. But what the rebuttal claims certainly is possible, and it doesn't ultimately change or affect any other part of my core analysis, because remember, the big picture for what is being rebutted is the idea that there was a whole additional bullet, or, you know, the handoff maybe went to someone else. And, you know, the idea was Nurse Bell gave it to some unknown person and then Nolan got a different bullet from a different unknown nurse. And so, hey, there's a whole extra bullet going on, you know, floating around out there. So that may or may not be true, but when it comes down to the bottom line of was CE-399 the single bullet, if there was a single bullet, I would rate it as strong conspiracy, primarily because I draw the inference that a bullet that goes through a body and hits rib bone and then hits wrist would not look like bullets that were shot into cotton, regardless of the muscle, regardless of the muzzle velocity. So, Jeff, what are your thoughts on that?
Agree with you wholeheartedly. I think I'm just, maybe it's the Occam's razor approach on this one, but I just think the simple answer is the most compelling. There's no possible way that this bullet could have taken that path, done all that damage, and ended up looking like it did.
Any thoughts on those rebuttals? There were three rebuttals in there just now.
There's a lot of views on the issue of weight, and you can cast doubt on what the weight might have been of what Conley took to the grave with him. I think that's the variable that we're talking about. But at least the analysis that I have seen, it's not even that close. I mean, the way you've analyzed it, it sounds like it's closer than what I have seen. I haven't studied that close enough to know, but let me just say this. There was actually a request, I think you probably know this, of the Conley family to actually take that out and answer the question once and for all. And they declined. I don't know why, but they did. Seems like that would have been a pretty simple thing to do.
Right.
For posterity. But you know, again, they did not. They made the decision not to. I think that's ancillary to the bigger question of whether or not that bullet was the one that did that damage. And I just don't think that the characteristics of that bullet are such that it did. And so I think the other questions are interesting, but not that relevant.
Right. Okay. Moving on to the third issue. Do the autopsy photographs and x-rays show Kennedy's body in the condition it was in when he left Parkland Hospital? So first we'll look at the issue of photographs and x-rays. Then we'll go look at the issue of body alteration. All right. So on the photograph and x-rays, we have John Stringer, who told the ARRB that he did not recognize the brain photos because he never took photos with a basilar view, which is underneath. And the cerebellum was damaged and cut in his photos, but the photos in the National Archives show that it's intact. He also said that he used different film and put ID tags on the photos. He did say in this ARRB interview that he wasn't sure of some things, and he said that, you know, his memory wasn't the greatest. So it is possible that, you know, he's not remembering everything exactly precisely. We do have to consider that. But I'm not just throwing out what he said, because he said some pretty serious things. If they were not supported by any other evidence and they completely stood alone, perhaps I would throw them out. Next, we have Robert Knudsen, and I'm excited to say his name appropriately. I had been saying Knudsen just because I had never seen someone with an N be pronounced after a silent K, but it's not a silent K. Hey, hey. All right. So Robert Knudsen told his family, who then told the ARRB, because Knudsen was not alive at the time, that Knudsen was the only photographer at the autopsy. But we know that John Stringer was an autopsy photographer. So Knudsen also said that in one of the photos, the hair had been drawn in on the back of Kennedy's head to cover a missing portion of the top back of the president's head. The next issue is Sondra Spencer. Sondra Spencer was a Navy warrant officer whose job was to process the film from the autopsy. And she told the ARRB that the photos in the record are not the ones that she remembered processing. And she even brought a copy of the paper that was used at the time, because they would buy their paper in bulk. And she had some of that paper. She brought it with her to compare it to the photos. And the paper used in the photos did not match the autopsy paper that was in the record, the photo paper. So you've got another fact that tends to point to, you know, some sort of shenanigans or deception in the autopsy. Then we have David Mantic, a radiologist, who says that the x-ray and photos of the back of the head are both forged. And he went to the National Archives 9 or 10 times before he made this conclusion. And he used an optical densitometer to measure the light that was coming from Kennedy's skull on the x-ray. When he did that, the back of the skull was too bright to be legitimate. He also used a stereo viewer on the photographs, and he determined that the photo that showed the back of Kennedy's head with no wound in the back rear was not consistent with the other photos. It should have appeared in 3D, and it appeared as if there was a patch that had been put in. That leads me to rebuttal number 5. The HSCA photo panel authenticated the photos and x-rays, and Stringer confirmed that he took the autopsy photos. Other witnesses also authenticated the autopsy photos. The fact that some of the photos were authenticated is consistent with there being multiple sets of autopsy photos. Knudsen told his family the truth. He was the only photographer at the autopsy that he, the photo session of at the autopsy that he participated in. And, you know, Stringer could have been the only one at the session he participated in. This is speculation without a doubt. But I understand that the official record says that the photos and x-rays are legitimate. And one would expect the official record to say that it is legitimate. So I don't dispute that. I did want to include it because it was a relevant rebuttal, I thought. My ultimate conclusion on the photos is that the photos do seem to have been altered, or they're from two different photo shoots. The two autopsies and two photo sessions is what would make the most sense to me, because we have Stringer and Knudsen both saying that they were the only photographers there. So for me, I rate the photographic authenticity as leaning conspiracy, not strong conspiracy, but it's a little bit past inconclusive for me. Your thoughts on the photo authenticity, photos and x-rays, before we go to the body alteration?
Well, you know, as far as who the official photographers were in the main event, it was absolutely John Stringer and with his assistant Floyd Reeby, no doubt about that. I mean, you know, there's 6 to 8 to 10 people that were participating heavily in all that, and the conversation, the validation of who was in the room doing that is very clear that it was Stringer and Floyd Reeby. Now, on the other hand, that, you know, that doesn't mean that Robert Knudsen didn't take a whole series of pictures. What he took pictures of is, you know, sort of the big $64,000 question. I lean where you lean. I think there was another session. I think there were two sessions where photographs were taken. And so I, you know, neither one of those testimonies is, you know, is false in that regard. Sandra Spencer, one of the things I think is just so amazing about her is her absolutely superb recollection of the details. She is a witness that almost by definition, when you listen or read what she says, she almost has instant credibility because of her recall. And, you know, clearly she sets forth another set of inconsistencies, which actually are reinforced by some of the things that Stringer says about the use of different films for different things. And, you know, obviously you have ektachrome and Kodachrome, you know, one's a slide film, one's a print film. You know, there's the whole issue of black and white versus color. And without getting into the details of that, he has some fairly strong statements, particularly when it comes to pictures of the brain related
right
to that. So I do think that he brings out some clear discrepancies as it relates to the pictures of the head, for sure.
Yeah, I agree. Let's look at body alteration. Okay, so again, just zooming out here, what we have going on here is we've got, you know, Dr. Gary Aguilar put out a paper that says there are 43 people whose initial recollections is that there was a large wound in the right rear of the president's head. So, in, you know, people can dispute each one of those 43. But the point is there were many, many people, dozens of people who said that. But we look at the x-ray and the autopsy photos, and that is certainly not the case at all. So one thing has to be true. Either the people that saw the head wound, that are numerous, the rear head wound, they were all mistaken or had a mass hallucination, or there's either photographic forgery, or the photos are authentic and there was some sort of body alteration that was done. So that's sort of the idea, the framing. So let's look at the arguments for body alteration real quick.
Okay, so I've never been a huge weed person, but this guy that I know, let's just say, is. So whether you're like me or the guy I know, or you're really into weed, whatever it is, you're about to nerd out big because there's this company called Mood, mood.com, that's changing the way people buy cannabis. Here's the science, and this is the part I love. The reason different cannabis strains make you feel different ways isn't just about THC. It's also based on other components called terpenes. Terpenes influence how your bud tastes and smells, but they also affect what you feel. So one terpene might make you feel uplifted and energetic, and another one makes you relaxed and sleepy. There are dozens of these. So when you have the right combination of terpenes, you can feel social, focused, creative, aroused, chilled out, or whatever. You just go to mood.com, click shop by mood, and that's it. Want to be more social at a party? There's flower for that. Need to focus and get more work done? There's flower for that. Want to melt into your couch and watch movies? Yep, flower for that too. And here's the part few people realize. It's now 100% federally legal to have really great bud shipped right to your door. It's third-party lab tested and comes in a discreet box. Best of all, everything is backed by Mood's 100-day satisfaction guarantee. And like I said, you can get 20% off with code JFK. So head to mood.com and get 20% off of your first order with code JFK. You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact that you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. So visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
There's the David Lifton sort of classical theory, which is that Kennedy's body was altered on the plane before the body arrived in Bethesda. And looking into that, I don't believe there's support for it, primarily because the only time the body wasn't accompanied on the plane is during the time when LBJ was sworn in. And, you know, Doug Horn would say the same thing. Certainly David Lifton, who passed away recently, made a lot of great contributions to research generally. I just think the core thesis doesn't appear to be supported by documentary evidence. Doug Horn, whose service for the ARRB, I have tremendous respect for, and I believe Doug Horn to be a credible person. He says that Kennedy's body was put into a cheap shipping casket and then surreptitiously taken to Bethesda via a helicopter, while the bronze ceremonial casket was part of a motorcade that arrived later. And the biggest problem that I have with this theory is that there's only one person I could find who said they personally heard a chopper land. There's only one person who supports this helicopter idea, and they heard it around 8 o'clock. And that's Paul O'Connor. He doesn't even say that he saw it land. There's one other guy who says I think Gerald Custer talked to somebody who mentioned it. But I was surprised at how little evidence there was for that. There's the Boyajian report that says that the body arrived around 6:35. Doesn't say, you know, how it arrived. So, you know, then you also have a testimony from four people, James Jenkins, Dennis David, Paul O'Connor, Gerald Custer. I'm sure there's more, about there being two caskets present, including a cheap shipping casket and a bronze ceremonial casket. And David and Custer both see this black hearse at the loading dock, which supposedly had Kennedy's body. And, you know, David even sees the body be taken out of the black hearse in a shipping casket. But then the motorcade arrived later with the bronze casket. So it's sort of, you know, this moving the ball around with the cups and trying to figure out where it is and what's what. But it does certainly appear that there was a shipping casket that was there and that he arrived in the shipping casket. If you believe the testimony of these folks who were physically there at the autopsy. Here's where rebuttal number six comes in. And this is actually a pro-conspiracy rebuttal. Most of my rebuttals are on the Warren Report defender side of things. So this rebuttal is, Gawler's call sheet says that the body was removed from a metal shipping casket at Bethesda. And I did not previously see this document, but that is true. I've looked at it now. And I do believe there were two caskets, and this Gawler's document that, I didn't know about before, is another piece of evidence to support that there was this shipping casket. But the counterpoint is that we don't have any evidence that any of the Gawler's employees were present when the casket was opened. So how would they know to write it down on the form? And again, you know, all this does is support a shipping casket, which there kind of already was support for. It doesn't do anything to support the helicopter story. So my conclusion overall is that the evidence is mixed on Doug Horne's theories regarding body alteration. I do believe that there was a shipping casket. I'm really unclear if there wasn't a chopper to get the shipping casket body there early. If the chopper story doesn't happen, I just don't think we have support for it. Maybe you do. I don't know. If it didn't get there earlier, I just don't know how they could have altered the body. But I believe there was a period of time when the other casket showed up and just kind of like sat there in the parking lot for a little bit. So it's confusing, but I ultimately find the body alteration to be inconclusive. I just really don't know on this one. So, Jeff, what are your thoughts?
First of all, I think it's irrefutable that he arrived in a shipping casket to the morgue. There are too many people, credible people that some of which you've named, that witnessed it. It's such an extraordinary story. To get your head around the idea that he actually arrived in a casket other than the one that appeared to have a complete chain of custody all the way from Parkland, you know, with the missus right next to him. And the Irish mafia within a foot or two away most of the time. It blows your mind to think that there ever was a moment that could possibly have allowed for anyone to have removed the body out of that casket and put it somewhere else. And so I think we get hung up on the fact that there's no clear evidence on how that might have happened. But, you know, at the end of the day, he ended up in a shipping casket. That's at the end of the day, he entered the morgue in a shipping casket. So because we didn't see it, doesn't mean it didn't happen. It had to happen. Somebody had to move him. I don't care if they touched his body or didn't. Somebody had to move him from a bronze casket to a shipping casket. That's number one. And number two is, if they did that, why? There is no credible reason why, unless they were planning on doing something. There is no, if it had not been nefarious in some way, there would have been a reasonable explanation. Someone would have said, this is what we did. We, you know, for security purposes, we did this or we did that. Mm-hmm. It was standard operating procedure in many cases to actually operate with two ambulances. One is a decoy. Right. So there were other reasons, but you know what? It's never been offered up. Now, you know, there's no witnesses saying that they moved them from one to the other, but I suspect that the people involved are clearly never going to be the kind of people that would admit to this. So at the end of the day, yes, we didn't see it. We didn't see somebody pull the trigger, so to speak, but we know that he was put in that casket because there's too many people, credible people, that saw him removed in the morgue from that shipping casket. So right. What do you do with that? I don't know what to do with it. I mean, you know, you and I have talked to some people mutually, as you know, and there are many theories about how and where, you know, that could have been done. I'm not going to speculate because I have no idea. Well, maybe I will. At the end of the day, I don't think any of those theories are very credible, even Horne's, in terms of where it happened. If you ask me, you know, the most likely place was maybe there was a moment at Parkland before they put the bronze casket in where they moved it. And then it just went its merry way differently. You know, it's quite possible that something like that could have happened because the chain of custody is tight enough, seemingly, between Parkland on the bronze casket itself all the way to Bethesda that it's hard to believe that at some point they snatched it. They snatched it out of Air Force One. I don't know. I mean, I think that if there was a physical transfer, it probably would have had to have happened even before then. You know what? I don't know. I have no idea. There's no credible evidence to show. Everything is a theory or a speculation, but you cannot refute the fact a series of highly credible witnesses that were right there said the president was lifted out of a shipping casket.
Yeah, that is true. I forget who was telling me this theory, but the idea, someone was saying the idea that, Earl Rose, they were worried that, you know, the local authorities were going to try to come get the body and there was going to be a standoff. So they moved him out of the into the shipping casket so they could just give up the bronze casket and then take off. But that is complete speculation with, you know, no basis in actual fact. We're trying to stick to the facts here. All right, let's go to, so inconclusive is where I land on the body alteration, but.
I didn't talk about the body alteration. Can I say one thing, about the body alteration?
Sure.
Go back to one photograph for a second. There's one publicly available photograph of the back of his head and it shows it completely intact. Okay. That's part of the quote, official photography.
Right.
If that one photo is a fake, I would say it is a fake, don't you think, with some 43 people indicating that there was a big hole in the back of his head? Okay.
Yeah. Well, you also can see the hand. You see that there's a hand. You don't know what the hand, it looks like the hand is holding it together to me when I look at the picture.
Well, there's a lot of discussion about the fact that a tremendous explosion inside the head can actually eject bone almost, you know, quickly through an incision in a way that the scalp and the skin of the scalp can actually be left intact and you can actually have a loss and you don't see it until the skin and the scalp are resected. And that's true. It is possible that that could happen, but we know based on the physical observations of so many of those people that you've referenced that in fact, that was not the case. It was a big hole. It was gone. Take that one picture. Every one of the pictures has to be authentic. You take that one picture, just that one. And what do you know about that picture? That picture is one of the biggest fantasies of all time. David Manick is, you know, based on what you just described, and he's a very, very credible individual in that discussion, you know, has indicated that there's a problem with that. And so if that one picture is not authentic, is it an improbable surmise that there are many other pictures in the middle of that are not authentic? And why would they just do one?
Right. Yeah. Well, I was surprised when I went to, you know, I mentioned the last episode, I was surprised going to Bugliosi's index and the only section on David Mantic, which is on the CD-ROM, by the way, was those two paragraphs that I read, you know. I was expecting like the Larry Sturdivant of photo analysis to like, you know, hey, look, optical densitometry is junk science and it's not real and blah, blah, blah. And I went in with one of these and it showed usually there's a lot of strong counter arguments. And I was really surprised there wasn't a counter argument to counter Mantic. So with no counter expert on that, it's interesting. So if any of the Warren Report, folks who believe the Warren Report is accurate, if you've got any experts that counter David Mantic, please send me that research. I'd love to see it. And it might be out there.
Mantic says one thing that's, I think, really compelling. The radiographic information says one thing, where the blowout is. The pictures, the photographic evidence, you know, presumably of the same body, say something quite different. The two are not reconcilable. The two, you can't take a picture of a hole in the head on the side or the back and have radiographs that look exactly the opposite. It's impossible for that to be consistent, which means that one or more of those pieces of evidence are false. You know, there's so much debate about all the sub details of this. But it is so glaringly obvious that these problems exist and they're irreconcilable that you know, again, it's not just one thing. There are so many basic pieces of evidence that point to things that may have been messed around with. How about the tracheotomy picture we talked about earlier?
Right. Yeah, it's much bigger. I believe Charles Crenshaw is on record. He wrote in his book that it was maybe 2.5 centimeters, and the one that he saw in the picture was 2 or 3 times the size, and it was like a lot wider too.
So I'm not a doctor, but as you know, I play one on TV. I spent all my life in hospitals and in hospital administration, and that picture is ridiculous. I think anybody who's in the medical field would tell you that there was just something really wrong. I mean, this was so blatantly bad, and we know that Perry didn't do that, and we know that Perry said he didn't do that. So somebody else, either somebody else dealt with it, or the picture is altered.
Right. Okay. Let's go to, just got a couple more issues left. Let's go to number 4. Here we go. Is the current Zapruder film that we all know authentic? So this is the story of Homer McMahon and Ben Hunter, who worked at NPIC, the National Photographic Interpretation Center. And it was their job to blow up photographs and films so that the higher ups could analyze them. Hunter and McMahon told the ARRB that they did their work on the Zapruder film frames on Sunday night. However, Dino Brugioni, who was the chief information officer for NPIC, said that he worked on creating the briefing boards of the Zapruder film on Saturday night, and he didn't do it with Hunter and McMahon. He also said that the briefing boards that he worked on showed a much more pronounced headshot with more blood and brain splatter going up than what is shown in the Zapruder film in the National Archives today. Brugioni's testimony tends to show that the Zapruder film could have been altered, but we also have a report from photo expert Roland Zavada that says that the Zapruder film was not altered. So this is competing inferences between an expert report and 3 witnesses who were there who tell you what happened. All right, so here's rebuttal number 7. Homer McMahon says in his ARRB testimony that he has senile dementia. This was surprising to me. I had never heard this before, and I went and looked at it, and that is true. McMahon literally says, I have senile dementia, and I can't remember many things. So he kind of disqualifies all of his testimony by saying that. So, you know, that's something worth noting for the record, because we really are relying on Homer McMahon. So we have to hope that, you know, if you want to believe that the Zapruder film is altered, you're kind of rolling the dice. I think that's fair, because he's on record saying, he's like, I have dementia. So this is true. And I had to read the transcript in full, and I would have included it if I knew about this. I think it's a relevant fact. And the fact of McMahon's dementia certainly undercuts the credibility of his testimony, and because really we're relying on him for this whole theory. So I rate the issue of whether the Zapruder film was altered as inconclusive. What are your thoughts on it, Jeff?
First of all, I'm not qualified to determination of whether it was altered or not. So I don't really have an opinion on it. What I do have an opinion on, as I do on all these things, because I think as an investigator, you would be concerned. When I did a lot in the Zapruder film, by the way, because the story of the Zapruder film is absolutely spectacular, by the way. It goes well beyond just the concept of, you know, it was a short film that chronicled the president. It has, as you know, ramifications for evidence and, you know, who owns evidence and, you know, and how it's retained in criminal cases and things like that. It's an amazing story. And we chronicled that on JFK, The Enduring Secret. But at the time, actually, I was unaware of the of Doug Horn's discussion about the fact that he had gone to NPIC and so on and so forth. So I completely did not cover that. I find that fact in and of itself disturbing. I mean, why would it have gone there? There's absolutely no reason for that film to have gone there. And, you know, again, it's presumptuous, but for it to have gone there, you have to presume that somebody potentially wanted to do something to it. And so I don't like the fact that it's there. It certainly points to the fact that there may have been, you know, bad intentions about how to treat that film, if there was something in it that was, you know, contrary to the narrative. I think this is such a complicated topic to figure out that I don't feel like I'm qualified to say one way or the other. I feel similar to you.
All right. Yeah. And certainly, I don't feel qualified to, you know, give a expert photographic interpretation. I guess I'm just saying weighing the witnesses versus the expert. And I've skimmed Rizzavada's report. It's very detailed. I couldn't, there's not like there's anything in there where I'm like, oh no, he's totally wrong. Like, no, I mean, it's a report you would expect an expert to write.
I mean, look, you start to speculate on what they changed in it, where, so on and so forth. Primarily, people would probably be concerned about the headshot and what that tells us about the either it coming from the front or the back. There's so much other evidence. Can I say just one quick thing? For instance, in the HSCA testimony by John Ebersole, the radiologist that was involved, when he was pressed to answer the question, he answered the question positively that there was likely a shot from the front. You know, it's not just what the Zapruder film says about back and to the left. There are lots of other things to point to that there was a shot, at least one shot, maybe more, that was not from the school book depository. And that's really all we're trying to understand about all of this, because beyond that, the facts are just not available at this moment to, because then you want to trace it back to who and why. Right. And that may never come to fruition just based on this forensic.
Sure. All right. Well, we've hit on the first four issues. Let's go to the fifth topic, which is really the big one. Which direction did the shot that hit Kennedy's head come from? The front, the back, or both? So a few little subtopics here I'll hit on, and then we'll open it up. The rear head wound was seen by as many as 43 people. Pretty much everybody at Parkland, not literally, but pretty much everyone at Parkland, and a lot of witnesses at Bethesda as well, were on record as their initial recollection being that the head wound was in the rear of Kennedy's head. And this includes very credible testimony from Dr. McClelland at Parkland, who was right next to Kennedy's head and had the best view out of all the Parkland doctors. The second thing is the cerebellum. So cerebellum is a little part of the brain that looks different than the rest of the brain tissue. It's you know, right near the brain stem, and it's at the lower part of the head. So we have 8 Parkland doctors, including, you know, and this is, I put a lot of weight on this, the chief of neurosurgery at Parkland, Dr. Kemp Clark. Clark, along with 7 other Parkland doctors, all say that they saw cerebellar tissue, meaning that the wound had to be low enough in the back of the head for the cerebellum to be visible. And seeing cerebellar tissue would rule out a parietal or side head wound, because, you know, that would be too high up to see the cerebellar tissue. Now, Humes and Boswell say that there was no damage to the cerebellum at all. So this is a huge split in witness testimony. And actually, McClellan says that he saw the part of the brain, part of the cerebellum, fall out onto the table. So, you know, that's very clear. And also John Stringer talks about the cerebellum that he saw being damaged. The next issue is we've got witnesses who saw the head entrance wound. Bethesda orderly Dennis David, Joe O'Donnell, who says that he was shown the photo by Robert Knudsen, and notably the mortician who prepared Kennedy's body for burial, Tom Robinson. We have the mortician saying there was an entrance wound. So they all say that they saw a small bullet hole in the president's temple. And, you know, that's not enough to prove that there was an entry wound there, but it's worth noting, given all of the other information that also corroborates a shot from the right front. Then we have Harper's fragment. So this was a piece of bone fragment that was found in the grass in Dealey Plaza the day after the assassination. And it was the guy that found it, his uncle was a doctor, I believe a pathologist.
His father was a doctor at Methodist, but he gave it to the chief pathologist at Methodist. Yes.
Right. So he gave it to the chief pathologist at Methodist Hospital, who determined that it was occipital. So if so, then that would, and again, this is the day after the assassination, right there where the shots were, that's where this bone was found. If it was occipital, then that would prove that there had to be a shot from the front because there's a rear exit wound. And of course, you know, if the x-rays and photos show the rear of his head intact, but he's missing an occipital bone, then we know that there's some sort of fraud going on. The counter argument is that it's not an occipital bone, it's a parietal bone. And you can find experts that say it's a parietal bone. And, you know, it'd be neat to hear a debate between experts on that. But again, the initial finding was that it was occipital. I don't know enough to know, you know, where the weight of the experts comes out on that granular issue, but worth noting. Then we have the Zapruder film, which shows Kennedy's body going violently back and to the left in the copy that we have today. You know, it's also true that there's damage to the right side of Kennedy's head in the film. What we don't see is a large explosion of blood and brain going forward. That's one thing to think about. You know, the place that the Warren Report puts the wound, and even the Clark panel where they move it, you would see an exit wound in the front somewhere. So we don't see that splatter of blood going forward on the film like you would expect if it was a shot from the back, in my view. But it does tend to show Kennedy was hit from the front because his body is going clearly back and to the left. That's the inference I draw when I watch the Zapruder film. And the Larry Sturtevant counterpoint about a last dying spasm causing this movement, that doesn't hold up under objective scrutiny, in my view, just because what he says happened with the goat, the last dying spasm, its arms, you know, its legs went out from under it. That's not what Kennedy did. He didn't flop his arms and legs out. He went back with the back into the left, consistent with being hit by something from the front. The next issue is the photos and the autopsy witnesses. So we've talked about this, but the autopsy photos of Kennedy's body, they don't show any damage past his ear. And Seibert and O'Neill both insisted that there was no damage past the president's ear. So again, using either location, the original location or the one that was moved up 4.5 inches, we would expect to see damage more to the face area or in front of the ear if it was really this, you know, it's coming in at the cowlick or it's coming in towards the bottom of his head. But we don't really see that. And I suppose the argument would be on the Clark panel revision that it just kind of nicked the top and then it, you know, it shot it out, and that's why there was like a hole on the right side only. So that would be the Clark panel argument, but certainly the original Warren Report placement, we would expect to see a hole in the front of the face, which is not there. Then we got Josiah Thompson and Dr. Michael Bodden, the whole, you know, was there a last second shot 7/10 of a second after the first shot hit him? I'd be curious to hear your opinion on this, Jeff. You know, in my view, it seems possible. I don't really know enough for sure, but it does seem like his head moves forward at that exact, and you know, it's really gory to watch. Okay. But then it looks different than it did right before that. And it goes forward, and the frames where Thompson puts it is exactly where Dr. Michael Bodden said that it could have been if it happened. So, you know, interesting and worth noting, but the main thing on the head wound to me is back into the left, and we have 43 doctors saying that there's an exit wound in the back of the head. And again, the autopsy things we've discussed and the witnesses we discussed. So that's how I ultimately reached the conclusion of Lean's conspiracy on did the headshot come from the front. I would say that it leans that it did come from the front.
Well, I do think there was a shot from the front. Most of the discussions about where people saw things are ridiculously sophomoric. they're trying to describe what should be a very precise location of something they saw by describing it generally. And it's cause for a tremendous amount of confusion when you listen to everybody's narrative about where they saw it. Everybody has a different view of, you know, what's in front of or back of the ear or below or this or that. When a visual on it, which is really what they should have focused on, you know, an exact location, could have removed a lot of the confusion around just exactly that. But, you know, Ebersol, when pressed, and I have to tell you that that 15 seconds or so in between when he was asked the question and when he finally answered, was probably the longest 15 seconds in all of the testimony of ARRB that's been recorded. But I have to believe that the experts in the room during the actual autopsy were the ones who could probably figure this out better than anyone. And there, and if you believe Gerald Custer, you know, he's another one. He was right there. He's got specific comments on certain radiographs that he's seen, things that he saw, the spray that was left and remained, that there's no question that, but there was a front shot. And so you've got people who are specifically involved. I've got James Jenkins, who believes he was shot from the front. These were people that were all in the room, not looking at documents afterward. They saw the real thing. Whether there was body alterations or not, they at least saw the president that night. And I think it's pretty clear that there was a shot from the front. Typically, this debate is about, did it come from the back and head down, or did it come from the front, you know, and head down to the back? And the exits are generally perceived to be larger than the entrances. So wherever the largest hole is, it wins the prize, so to speak, in simple layman's terms about where the exit is. And so you have, by nature, conflicting evidence between the photographs and the radiographs as a result. And it's pretty clear. I think it's not a big leap. I have to tell you, I'm not a conspiracy guy, by the way. You know, I don't like immediately like run in and go, I think there's a conspiracy. I went into this 163 episodes ago with an absolutely clear mind about what might or might not have been. Curious, of course, right? About conspiracy. I will tell you, after being knee deep in all of the true evidence of this case, it's very clear that there were things done in the middle of the autopsy to obfuscate what was there. Again, we can speculate about exactly what was done or not done, but why would you do that? Why would you do that unless there was something that you feared was a problem? And the only problem that the government had at that moment was something that was contrary to a single assassin firing all of those bullets from one place. That's the only thing. And so it's not a big intellectual leap to understand that all of these things lead to the same place, that there was some level of alteration. Now, yeah, you have to ask yourself whether there was a legitimate reason at that moment, whether the country was really worried about what was happening and that was done for good purpose or not.
I wanted to get your thoughts on Admiral Berkeley, just the whole saga of him reaching out to the HSCA and then the authors over the years and then his daughter. To me, him, this letter from his lawyer, it's not like there was ever a time when, you know, Berkeley's daughter or Berkeley or someone said, hey, this HSCA document is fraudulent. I never authorized my lawyer to do that. We don't have anything like that. It's not disputed at all. It's in the records that the lawyer called. Berkeley wants to confess that there's a conspiracy. Whoa. And then the daughter said, hey, I'll sign the papers over. And then, you know, Gunn followed up from the ARRB. And then she said, take a hike. So that was another one of those things that you go, wow, if it's not a conspiracy, then how do you explain that behavior?
I think it's another perfect example of, and here's a guy who is obviously very high up, very powerful in and of himself and in that role at that moment, and certainly highly connected, I'm sure, even toward the end of his life in the military establishment. And even there was some form of hesitation. Somebody got to him and said, don't do it. Probably. I think that's the likely answer. And he may not, again, speculation, but probably didn't share those kinds of things with his daughter. But as soon as his daughter elected to do that, you know, there's somebody got to her too and said, you know, it's not a good idea for you to do this. And there's no plausible explanation for a 180, look, anybody could walk in and say, look, Jeff, a trusted advisor to the family could have called her and said, look, there's just more to this, probably more to this story. You know, there's no reason for you to get yourself involved. You should just turn around and say no. It might have been as innocent as that. No one really knows. It's never been revealed why she changed her mind or why some of those things didn't occur at that moment. But it certainly begs the question that toward the end of his life, he decided to come clean and tell the story. You know, the Harper fragment is interesting. Do you know it's missing? It went missing.
I heard that, yeah.
It went missing. The chief medical photographer at Methodist took 12 pictures of it after both A.B. Cairns and Gerhard Noteboom, along with Dr. Harper, all three of them concluded that it was occipital bone. And they took 12 pictures of it before they shipped it off. And the FBI wanted it, so it went to Berkeley and then presumably, I guess, to the FBI, where it's never been seen before since. And the work that the HSCA did on it was, you know, purely through those 12 photographs. And, you know, sadly enough. And I think Noteboom appeared on a show in California on the 29th anniversary of the assassination. And he reiterated the fact that all three of them were pretty clear that they thought it was occipital. But my point is, these are the kinds of things that Berkeley probably had intimate knowledge about. And I'm sure there was an accumulated set of things around it, including the family ramifications and the ramifications to RFK. And now that RFK was gone, there was probably a moment in time where he was likely going to come clean. And when I say come clean, not like he had some involvement in it, but he had intimate, he was the only, as you know, and you've said it, he's the only medical person who was actually on site at Parkland and at Bethesda. And it's pretty clear that he was likely effectively managing the autopsy and the wishes of the Kennedy family. It was, you know, he was probably primarily involved in directing the autopsy that night.
Sure. All right. Well, I think that's we could sit here and go back and forth forever. There's a lot of stuff to cover. I think that pretty much wraps up, you know, most of the issues I had down for us to cover today. Jeff, appreciate your time with us today. Any parting thoughts before we go?
Well, I just want to say again, I am really enjoying listening to your podcast. As you know, I wander. A lot of people don't like that, but you get right to the point and you're succinct. And I find myself wanting to listen to your podcast more than any other podcast related to the Kennedy assassination. And I just hope you keep it up, and I hope you keep asking me back, because it's fun to just hang out with you.
Yeah, man.
And hopefully we can do more of this.
Cheers. And I know you've been diving deep into this, and you're obviously a very smart professional guy, and you've got your ducks in a row, and you know a lot of stuff about the case that I don't know. And that kind of, you know, the things that you end up knowing is just kind of what sources do you look at, and there may be a source you missed here or there, and there are some that I've missed. So I definitely appreciate all your help and your willingness to come and kind of go through all the details and figure out what's what. And yeah, man, would love to do it again. So appreciate you coming on, Jeff. Thanks, man.
You're welcome.
In the next recorded produced episode of Solving JFK, we look at Oswald as a shooter. So we're going to talk about You know, could anyone have made those shots in that time? What did the firing test show? And then how was Oswald as a shooter? So among a few other issues. Then we go to J.D. Tippett. We get a super deep dive on J.D. Tippett. Then we go to, you know, his arrest, Oswald in the jail, and then Jack Ruby killing Oswald. So that will be the end of this season, and then we'll kind of go from there and make our conclusions. But again, Jeff, thank you so much, man. We appreciate it, and we'll talk to everybody soon. Thanks.